Previously on Willing to Adapt.
This is one of my favorites. Today we are talking about the original fairy tale version of The Sleeping Beauty.
Fairy tales have existed for quite some time. Mm-hmm.
There's a fallacy out there that Disney created these things.
Yes.
When they really did not, they just adapted them. You can see it has like the semblance of the original story, but it's definitely less what they would say immoral.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of ways, they just kind of cleaned it up, and they definitely took out the aspect of rape.
Yes, that definitely was gone. Yeah.
The first major adaptation that Sleeping Beauty ever saw, and that is the ballet by Tchaikovsky.
What? Disney was not the first?
Nope, it was not. No ballet. Horrible. like all the cool things they got to do, especially the guys, because the guys got to like lift all the girls and like throw them around and all these things. Like, I was like, this is fun. This is cool. But then it's also really tough. I was like, this is not easy. Like, this thing is a sport, you know?
It's all dancing to me.
I'm glad that you liked it, though.
I did. I'm actually looking forward to watching another ballet. I wouldn't mind.
I really was not sure how you were going to like it.
I'm a ghetto intellectual.
Sure.
I'm Eric Von Crumley.
And I'm Romy Reyes.
Have you ever wondered how a book becomes a movie?
Or how a movie becomes a musical?
Or how anything is adapted at all?
Join us as we talk about your favorite stories and all the changes that were made along the way.
But more importantly, why? This is Willing to Adapt.
Hi, welcome back to Willing to Adapt. I'm Eric Von Crumley.
And I'm Romy Reyes.
In case you didn't hear the first two parts of this episode of Sleeping Beauty, in the very first one, we talked about the origins and the source material for Sleeping Beauty, or the very first one, Sun, Moon, and Talia, which was weird. Mm-hmm. And in the second episode, we talked about the Sleeping Beauty ballet, which I'm glad you liked.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the reason why I wanted to talk about the ballet, besides the fact that I love the ballet, it's good, is because the ballet is actually very important in regards to this adaptation.
It's very much a stepping stone. Yes. I think I mentioned that last week.
So which adaptation are we talking about now?
Today we're going to talk about the 1959 Disney version of Sleeping Beauty. It was...
This is probably the one that people are the most familiar with, too.
Most likely. This is the one I saw first, even mm-hmm. before the fairy tale.
Yeah. So when did you first watch this?
I'm sure... I didn't watch it in theaters because I wasn't alive yet.
I mean, I would say you look really good.
No. I'm pretty sure I watched it on The Wonderful World of Disney.
Nice.
Before that, I know I'd seen snippets of it on those musical
mm-hmm.
pastiche things they would do with all the different snippets of the different cartoons and movies and things like that.
Oh, yeah. I think I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I grew up with this one on VHS.
Okay.
Yeah. I loved this one. Ever since I was a kid, I've loved this one.
I know I've only seen it maybe once or twice when I was a kid, because mm-hmm. in rewatching it this last weekend, there was a lot I did not remember.
Oh. So yeah. You were like pleasantly happy then, huh?
Not just that. I was actually pleasantly surprised with how intricate and beautiful the animation was.
Right? I think this one's very underrated.
It is, because I grew up... Not grew up, sorry. When my daughter was born, she watched... Cinderella mm-hmm. incessantly.
And which, Cinderella is good.
It is. Yeah. And as is...
And we'll talk about that one another time for sure.
And she also watched Peter Pan. One. But mm-hmm. those were the two in Lion King. And so I watched those a lot. Mm-hmm. And that's the classic Disney era animation I was thinking of when I put this one on to watch. So to see the quality... of the animation was actually very surprising.
And I
want to say I paid a little bit more attention to the like the detail of the dungeon walls and the forest, maybe even more so than the story, since I'd already read the other ones.
For sure. Let me give a very brief synopsis in case somebody out there has not seen this movie. Please go watch it. This movie is only an hour and 19 minutes long.
Yeah, very short.
I was shocked. Mm-hmm. I think I knew that, but my watch of this last time, I was like, my gosh. Because it's... Oh, my gosh. Just because, like, the ballet was 2:19, probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so this is an hour less, which, I mean, it makes sense. But still, you would think it'd be longer. So for Disney's Sleeping Beauty, It is set in the late medieval period.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's like one of the first times that it's actually set in that, too. Yeah, it's not traditionally set in that time period, mm-hmm. which I like it. I think it's gorgeous. But it's the late medieval period, and King Stefan and his wife cannot bear a child.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually they can. And they name her Aurora after the dawn. Mm-hmm. She filled their lives with sunshine. And so, of course, you know, they celebrate. Everybody's invited from all over, and they come to celebrate the new princess, Aurora.
Mm-hmm.
And they all come to the castle, and among the people who come to the castle, and this is new for the Disney version, are King Hubert, who's, like, a good friend of King Stefan, mm-hmm. and he's, like, the king of a neighboring kingdom.
Yeah.
And with him is his son, Prince Philip. And you find out that Prince Philip is betrothed to Aurora,
mm-hmm.
and so eventually they will be married. And besides them, we meet the three good fairies, mm-hmm. Flora, Fauna, and Merryweather. Of the three of them, they bestow three different gifts, and they are the gift of beauty, song, and we don't find out what Merryweather's is going to be because she is interrupted by the evil fairy Maleficent.
So is she a fairy? I thought they
referenced her as a witch. I think Disney refers, not in the movie, they don't refer to her as a fairy, but in other things Disney has referred to her as an evil fairy.
Okay, because I could have sworn they called her a witch. I don't know if that was just a euphemism or if it was...
I don't know if they call her that in the movie or not, but she definitely has magic.
Yeah.
But anyways, so Maleficent arrives and, you know, she pretends to be hurt that she wasn't invited, and Merryweather says that she wasn't wanted. And, you know, of course, she decides to leave a gift with Aurora anyways. And she tells the traditional curse of she'll grow up. But on her 16th birthday, she will prick her finger on a spinning wheel,
mm-hmm.
the spindle of a spinning wheel, and die. And before she can be seized by the guards, she disappears into thin air. And Merryweather, who had not given her gift yet, is able to kind of diminish the curse. And so that it's not she'll die, it's that she'll just sleep until she's woken up by love's first kiss.
Yeah.
And so, a way to protect Aurora, King Stefan has it so that all the spinning wheels in the kingdom are burned. So that it just reduces all the threat.
Mm-hmm.
And then, this is when the story focuses on the three good fairies. I'm going to point it out right now to everybody. The one misconception that everybody has about this movie is who the protagonist is. The three protagonists for this film are the three good fairies.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
The story is called Sleeping Beauty, but she's not the protagonist because all the characters that push the story and whose actions affect the plot are mm-hmm. the three good fairies. We follow their choices throughout the whole movie. Have you noticed?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So people don't notice. People don't realize that, but that was a conscious decision. Yeah. But one of the things we did not mention in when we talked about the ballet is Tchaikovsky, when he was writing his music, and you know when they were creating the ballet, is they really tried to kind of lean into this battle between good and evil,
mm-hmm.
and you can hear it in his music, the ballet between good and evil, and that's why they introduced the Lilac Fairy. Because the Lilac Fairy was okay. supposed to be in opposition to Carabas.
Yeah.
And I'm mad that I didn't introduce that before, but there you go. And so when Disney made their movie, they leaned into that more. And they really leaned into the battle between good and evil.
That's why I felt the ballet was a good... I'm glad... Because I know you think it last time you said you had me watch it, but you actually gave it as a optional. And so I'm really glad I watched it, though.
Mm-hmm.
Because... you can see
how we got to this. Mm-hmm. Yes,
the stepping stone. Yeah.
And then I'll just straight up say, like, the music is like almost all taken from the ballet.
Yeah
we'll get to that though.
Yeah, well, even I want to say even the costume they use, I don't know how that kind
of some of it's play. Affected by it. Yeah, but so anyways, in the plot, the one of the big differences besides what I said is Aurora does not stay with her family.
Mm-hmm.
The three good fairies decide that they want to protect her.
Mm-hmm.
And so they take the prince... I guess they ask for permission, but they take the princess away from her parents to protect her, and they hide her deep within the forest. Mm-hmm. And the fairies decide not to use magic so they don't draw attention to themselves, and they behave as normal peasant women.
Yes.
For 16 years to protect Aurora. And, you know, 16 years pass, and Maleficent's angry because she hasn't found Aurora yet, and basically her minions are stupid because they've been looking for a baby this whole time. And so she sends out her raven to go search for Aurora. She describes her, and the raven goes and looks for her. And so what ends up happening is the three good fairies send Aurora out to go just basically just distract herself while they're preparing a secret birthday surprise for her, which is they're making a birthday cake and a dress. But they're trying to make it from scratch without any magic still. And so that becomes part of the comedic relief a little bit. But while Aurora is out in the woods, you know, she's singing and she has her little animal friends who kind of join her. And while she's out there, Prince Philip happens upon her. And he doesn't know who she is. And she has never really met anybody else because she's been hidden away this whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of is attracted by her singing. And so he and his horse go after her. And he ends up losing his cape and his hat and stuff. And it looks kind of like this would be like hunting.
Mm-hmm.
The animals take it because it was drying because he got wet. And so Aurora is singing about how she keeps dreaming about this guy. She sings Once Upon a Dream. And the animals go and pretend to be the man from her dreams while she's dancing. Mm-hmm. And then while that's happening, Prince Philip shows up and he starts dancing with her. And very quickly they fall in love. You know, it's love at first sight kind of thing. And they start talking. And then she realizes she's not really supposed to be around strangers. And so she quickly leaves. But then, like, basically invites him to come back later that night.
Yeah.
But he doesn't know who she is and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So they both kind of just assume that they're both just peasants.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when she
Well, she still thinks at this point she's a peasant.
Well, yes, of course. Yeah. Yes. But, like, she thinks he's a peasant and he thinks she's a peasant girl.
Mm-hmm.
And so she returns home, and of course, you know, the three good fairies are doing a very terrible job at what they're trying to do. One of my favorite lines is when they're trying to make the dress, mm-hmm. and Meriwether's playing the dummy.
Yeah.
And she looks at the dress, she's like, it looks awful. And she says, well, that's because it's on you, dear. Some really good throwaway lines in this movie. Anyways, so the cake is a disaster because Fauna can't make anything, and the dress is terrible, and so Meriwether convinces them to use magic, which would have been fine, except that Meriwether and Flora get into like a little bit of a brawl with their magic because they keep debating whether Aurora's dress should be pink or blue, right? And so, because of this, even though they took measures to conceal magic, they didn't close the flue, apparently, in the chimney. And so, when the raven's flying by, he notices the magic coming out from the chimney. And so, that's what draws him in. Which I like, because it's their mistake that pushes the plot.
Yeah.
Right? Like, if they hadn't done that, like, they'd probably been fine. Fun fact, real quick. You know the whole bit about, like, make it pink, make it blue?
Mm-hmm.
That they included that, if only because the animators didn't know what color to put her in, and the animators fought over the colors.
That's funny.
And so somebody had the idea, well, let's just include this as part of the story, and it worked with the characterizations.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why in the movie she predominantly wears blue for like most of the movie, but that's why they do go back and forth at times.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and it's funny because when you go to the parks and like most of the merchandise, she wears pink almost all the time.
Yeah,
but I think they try to differentiate her from other princesses.
Especially since Cinderella ended up being blue.
Mm-hmm.
Works out that way.
Well, it's funny because in the movie, it's actually like a silvery white. If you've watched that. So Aurora comes back. She wants to tell, I think she kind of calls them her aunts, but the three good fairies. Like, she met someone.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're unhappy about this because they need to return her to her parents. And she's betrothed. And they don't know what to do with this. And so they tell her the truth. But, of course, the raven's there. So the raven overhears the truth. And the raven finds out this is Aurora. And so the raven races off. You know, Aurora is, you know, heartbroken that she can't see the man that she met.
Mm-hmm.
you know, there's a quick cut back to when King Stefan and King Hubert are, you know, they're having like a drinking game, basically. They're singing, they're toasting, they're excited that Aurora's coming back. They're excited for the marriage and stuff, but King Stefan doesn't want to rush things because he misses Aurora because he hasn't seen her in 16 years, basically. And then, of course, you know, Prince Philip shows up and he tells his father that he's not going to marry Aurora because he met a peasant girl that he loves and he plans to marry her. And, of course, you know, King Hubert's upset by this and now he has to tell King Stefan that the marriage is basically off. And then Prince Philip goes off to go meet Aurora without knowing it's her, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, at this time, Aurora is being led to the castle by the three good fairies. She's dressed very elegantly. They're all in, like, their fairy clothes again. Mm-hmm. But they're sneaking her back into the palace because they don't want anybody to see her. They don't want her to get in trouble because the sun has not set yet.
Yeah.
That's something specific to their version. Disney had a ticking clock.
Okay.
By including the idea of before the sun sets on her 16th birthday.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't catch that.
Uh-huh. And so they sneak her up, and what I like is they actually, because they leave her alone after giving her a little tiara, mm-hmm. and she's crying, so they leave her alone for a bit. I like in the Disney version how they actually consider telling the king and the queen about how she met this person in mm-hmm. the woods. Like, I like that they talk about, like, they should.
Yeah.
And then, of course, while they're talking, Maleficent appears with her, like, green little magic ball.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear in the music Aurora is being said.
Mm-hmm.
And then she very quickly becomes hypnotized.
Yeah.
Another fun fact. I did not know this until I did the research. Apparently, Mary Costa played the voice of Aurora. That's her voice for that scene.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, it's her voice attracting Aurora.
Oh, okay.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was an interesting choice. And that's a big difference, again, because in the original version, she's just kind of curious and she stumbles onto the spindle.
Yeah.
But in this version, she's being, like, kind of hypnotized and, like, led up to the tower to the spinning wheel.
Which kind of matches the ballet version.
A little bit. Like, in that she was tricked to into it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I like it. It's fun. It's mm-hmm. it's compelling.
And you mentioned the whole Briar Rose thing, too, didn't you?
Not yet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, thank you. I was going to forget that one. I kept telling myself, don't forget that. So, if you remember, listeners, in the one of the differences between the Brothers Grimm version and kind of the Perrault version
mm-hmm.
is the names.
Yes.
And so, when Disney was making Sleeping Beauty, they were trying to figure out, well, what's going to be her name?
Mm-hmm.
And so, they were looking at all the different versions, for the most part. Mainly the Grimm version and the Perrault version. So, the, mm-hmm. like, it was basically like, which version are we going to go with, French or German, right?
I believe in the ballet, she's called Aurora.
She is, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but of course, Disney was trying to look at all the subject, the material and everything. And so, I like that they call her Aurora, that's her real name, mm-hmm. and then when she's basically in disguise and is living in the forest, that's when they call her Briar Rose.
Correct, yeah.
Yeah. I like it.
Mm-hmm.
It works. And I like that that's what the fairies refer to her as. Like, even later in the movie, like, they say Rose, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I forget that. But anyway, so she's being led up, kind of hypnotized by Maleficent, and the three fairies are racing to stop her because they know what's going to happen. And I kind of like it's one of the most exciting scenes for me is mm-hmm. this whole bit here because the music is swelling and and you hear Meriwether saying, like, don't touch anything.
Yeah.
And there's a brief moment where, like she's, like, not hypnotized and she, like, hears it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Maleficent says, touch the spindle. And then she touches it. And but then if you notice, because I told you there's, like, that ticking clock with the sun setting.
Mm-hmm.
Is, like, when Maleficent says, like, here's your precious princess. Mm-hmm. That's a tongue twister. Here's your precious princess. And then she reveals that Aurora's on the floor, apparently dead, you know?
Yeah.
When the fairies go up to her, it goes to the window and you see the sunset.
Mm.
And it's like they barely, like so close, you know?
Yeah.
And so in this version, another big departure is everyone's waiting for Aurora, of course, because the sun has now set. So she's going to come at any point. And so there's like this juxtaposition of like everyone's excited and cheering and the fireworks are going off, but like it's sad because she's asleep and like she didn't make it. But one of the biggest changes is the three good fairies say, essentially, we're not going to let the king and queen find out about this, and we're going to put them all to sleep until we fix this.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's not 100 years. It's which I'm fine with, because in some of the fairy tales it was just many years, or like it's an undisclosed amount of time. Also, this is the first time that Aurora has had a someone that she's had any sort of relationship with before going to sleep. So I think that's a really good step forward.
Yeah.
Like, I like that they had a relationship, and that, like, they kind of, even if it was abrupt, like, the fact that they had that relationship is, like, a big deal. And so, of course, you know, she falls asleep, and when they're putting her to sleep, Flora overhears Hubert trying to tell King Stefan about what Prince Philip said. Mm-hmm. And so then Flora realizes, oh my gosh, Prince Philip is that peasant boy.
Mm-hmm.
And so she and the rest of the fairies race off to go find him.
Well, the funny thing I thought of in that is that they put everyone to sleep, just like in all the other stories.
Right.
But Prince Philip was, he had left ahead of time because he was going to go find his
peasant girl. Yeah.
So he happened to be away at that moment. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I like that they realize, oh my gosh, like Prince Philip was the peasant boy, like he's the one that can wake her up.
Yeah.
And so they race to go get him because they know where he's going. Because he's coming to the cottage that they used to live in. But when they're racing there and he shows up, he's taken prisoner by Maleficent. And I also like this because Maleficent realizes, like, and almost like out of spite, like, that she just won't be beaten, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, if I prevent her from being woken up, essentially, like she does everything she can to just stop at them, you know? And so I like that they say that she was not expecting Prince Philip. She was just expecting some peasant boy. And, of course, then, you know, the three good fairies realize they have to go save Prince Philip, because in order to save Aurora, they have to save him.
Correct.
And so, you know, they sneak off to the Forbidden Mountain where Maleficent lives, and it's basically like the creepiest place possible.
Yeah.
They sneak in, and I really like that essentially when, you know, everyone's celebrating there, that it's Maleficent's pride and like spitefulness that she has to rub it in to Philip about what happened. That's kind of what works against her in the end.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because she goes down to him, and he's like in the dungeon, of course, and she's talking to him and says, like, you know, don't worry, you know, that peasant girl you liked, oh my gosh, it's Aurora, you know?
Yeah.
And like, she's asleep, but you can wake her up. Mm-hmm. And she's like, in like 100 years. But it's like this like moment where it's like, will she still want you in 100 years, you know?
Yeah, because she gives him that vision of him. Yeah,
being super elderly. Old and... Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to like this valiant figure racing off. And...
But I thought it was interesting they added that as a homage to the original.
Right. Yeah. Year. Like it really worked, I think, for the story. And you know, of course, she leaves to go to sleep, and you know, the raven is suspicious because he kind of overheard the three good fairies listening in, and anyways, the three good fairies come and they break him out, essentially, and they give him like a sword and a shield, and we'll talk about that. They basically are to combat evil, and they start to break him out, and then the raven stops them and gets like the whole, like, I don't know, like demons, I guess, to come and attack them. And so like anytime anything bad's gonna happen, like pouring like, I don't know, acid or something onto him, it gets turned into flowers and like, or a rainbow, and he's like, the arrows get turned into flowers, stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
And then Meriwether turns the raven into stone, and then Maleficent comes out and she sees what's happening, and so this is like the ultimate climax, of course, and this is missing from like all the fairy tales.
Yeah,
is like this ultimate climax, and you can see this like where the battle of good and evil like really comes into play in the Disney version. And so Maleficent's trying to stop him, of course. And so this is, I like how they use all the beats from the fairy tales in like their condensed story time, and in their own way, is because like she's trying to stop him, like she's like breaking up by lightning the ground in front of him and stuff, but he keeps racing towards the castle to wake up Aurora, and she sends like the thorns around King Stefan's castle, and like that's in the fairy tale.
It is.
It's a little different, but
it is. Yeah.
I like that they include it there like that, and it's to stop him. And then, of course, he's getting through, and so the one of the biggest departures again is she turns into a dragon. And she's fighting, and of course he wins.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course he goes and he wakes up Aurora, and then everybody else wakes up, and it's funny, this time around, I didn't quite understand this until this last time, which I don't know why I didn't, except I just grew up with the movie and just didn't think about it. Nobody knows what happened except for the three good fairies and Prince Philip.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, they all just woke up and just, like, didn't realize that time had passed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, Aurora's aware of some stuff, but...
Yeah. And it was only, like, a day or so.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I just think it's funny that it's, like, we're just gonna... No one's gonna question, you know? Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was the point for the version. And so, of course, you know, King Hubert's trying to tell King Stefan still, but then you find out, oh, nope, they're together.
Yeah. They come down the stairs.
Yeah, and he's so confused, and and of course they dance, and it ends, and everyone's happy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's the very long synopsis.
Traditional Disney.
Yeah, but you know, it was very... You know, they made changes, for sure, mm-hmm. but it was still very faithful.
It was. Yeah. No, it was, yeah. I mean, the presence of good and evil was a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
This one, the I think a morality...
I think my excitement and my talking can explain to you how I feel about this movie.
Yeah. The morality of it was very different, whereas the other one supposedly had a moral to it. This mm-hmm. one was more your traditional, what some would call a Disneyfied fairy tale.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important for people who want to criticize Disney movies,
mm-hmm.
especially like Walt Disney movies. Because he did make a lot of really good changes
mm-hmm.
to the fairy tales.
Yeah.
I think for the better, for sure.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, from a modern eye, it for some people it might not be what they want.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't deny that it is much better than what it was working with.
I don't know. The whole ogre eating children thing.
Rape.
Yeah. Oh, maybe that one. That one definitely. You have to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways, so I have a bunch of notes. Do you want to talk about anything before I go into some of the making and stuff?
Nope.
All right. So the film was mm-hmm. in production at the Disney Studios for nearly a decade. And story work actually began in 1951,
mm-hmm.
Which is like almost a decade before it came out. And the dialogue was recorded in 1953. And the actual animation took from the same year the dialogue was recorded until 1958. And the musical score, drawn almost entirely from the ballet, was recorded in the same year the animation production finished. And obviously we said the movie was released 2 months later in 1959. The movie was selected for preservation in the National Film Registry by the Library of Congress, which deemed it culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant in 2019.
Hmm.
Did you know that?
Nope.
That's nice.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing I thought about this time around, especially after watching the ballet,
mm-hmm.
is it's actually, if you think about it in a weird way, both the ballet, but especially the Disney movie especially,
mm-hmm.
is a simple story told on a grand scale.
Mm-hmm.
Have you thought about that?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the random things I appreciate about this movie is that it actually shows how colorful the medieval period was.
Okay.
That's something most people don't think about. People think the medieval period is really grim and drab and stuff, but it was actually very colorful.
Yeah.
Yeah, and people don't notice that. Like, even just, like, in the costumes and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all the elements and the plot points from the tale, they represent just kind of a more imagining and a retelling, I guess. I have a bunch of random notes. This is something that I found... I was kind of aware of this just from watching it so many times, but when I was looking at behind the scenes for the making of this, they were talking about the artistic direction and stuff. And what I found interesting is the movie had a couple of motifs to it, like artistic motifs.
Mm-hmm.
And in the environment specifically, they really liked this elongated vertical lines look. So like a lot of the trees and like with the staffs and flags and even just, like, obviously the Gothic architecture, like, they wanted it all to be very cohesive.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted, like I said, the synergy between the characters on the screen and the background. and all that. So a lot of it is, there's a lot of very vertical lines to it. And that was like the way they wanted the world to look. But when it came to magic, there was a heavy use of spirals, which are the opposite.
Yeah.
And so like anytime somebody's using magic, it was like a spiral into something.
Okay.
Which I thought was very interesting. Obviously, you know, it was a very gothic looking movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was Mark Davis, one of the animators. He was just randomly in New York for something, and he came across a bunch of gothic tapestries.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was like, specifically, it's a very famous one. I can't remember the exact name of it, but it's like the unicorn one. And he saw that and he said, that's what the movie should be. Because it's so ornate and it's a very specific style. And so they took inspiration from a lot of gothic tapestries and like European paintings and folios from the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they used those as artistic direction.
Okay.
And they specifically said in many different sources, they wanted the movie to look like a moving gothic tapestry.
Mm.
And in many scenes it does.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they, so many behind the scenes and interviews and everything say specifically, this was a design driven film.
Mm. That makes sense. Yeah. I can see that.
In so many ways.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that Walt Disney, a little bit of background, I'm not going to go into like the history of the Walt Disney Company. I think it's prolific enough, and if it's not, it doesn't matter. But Walt always was trying to push the envelope.
Mm-hmm.
He obviously was famous in the beginning for his cartoons.
Yeah.
And he, you know, the biggest first thing he did was Snow White.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was the very first for him, like the full-length animated feature.
Yes.
And it was a very big deal. It took itself very seriously. It was very comedic in some ways. It was dark, obviously, and it took liberties with the story. But that was a really big deal. That was the very first time. And that could have, like destroyed the company.
Mm.
That was a big risk for them.
Yeah.
And it paid off. And you can see in, like, the few movies that came out after it, it was still actually very artistic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they did Bambi.
Mm-hmm.
And they did Pinocchio. I think Pinocchio was next, but... but then, like, not even soon after that, like, within 5 years or so, they did Fantasia.
Yeah.
This company that barely started making feature-length movies did a movie based off of classical music.
Mm-hmm.
And people forget that.
Yeah.
Like, people think about Disney as this, like, really weird, like, family, like, comedic, weird fairy tale thing.
Mm-hmm.
When Disney actually, when Walt Disney was alive, only made 3 princess movies.
Mm.
And people forget that.
Yeah.
But the reason why Disney kept coming back to quote-unquote princess movies is those were the ones that made money.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. And so, obviously, Fantasia did not do very well. Mm-hmm. But that was Disney's attempt at what some people call high art.
Mm.
Like, Disney took that movie very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was a very big artistic endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't really pay off very well, but... to this day, it's still, like, artistically amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so, you know, there's a lot that went on. There was, like, the company didn't do well at one point. There were some strikes that was happening. Obviously, it was the Great Depression, and I mean, they got through the Great Depression, but, like, they were struggling for a while, and then there was World War II.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of just made do for a while because of the war, and the company wasn't doing super well. But then, after the war, the company started doing better.
Mm-hmm.
And they came out with Cinderella. And Cinderella did very well.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when they started kind of working on Sleeping Beauty a little bit. It was just like, Disney was making a lot of movies, and so there's things just here and there.
Yeah.
And so then Disney tried to do, like, Alice in Wonderland and Peter Pan, and like, which were not princess movies.
No. Yeah.
And those movies didn't do as well. And so then they really pushed to do another princess movie.
Mm-hmm.
The company was still in a much better place than they were before.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a very big risk to still make Sleeping Beauty. Like, if the movie did not do well, like, it probably still... because at the same time, they were making Disneyland.
Oh, okay.
And Disneyland, again, could have bankrupted the company.
Yeah.
Walt Disney consistently was, like, innovating and pushing the envelope. And there's so many times that it could have just destroyed him, and it didn't. And I think that's a testament.
Mm-hmm.
To, like, the creativity and stuff. Like, not everything he made was golden, obviously. Like, there are some problematic stuff here and there. I think, on the whole, like, his movies are just something... a cut above the rest, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree.
all that to say, when they came to make Sleeping Beauty, Walt Disney specifically said, I want this movie to stand out. I don't want to make another Snow White. Because he said that there are some similarities in the story.
Mm-hmm.
And he specifically said on many times, almost like as a mantra to people,
mm-hmm.
do not make another Snow White. And so he really leaned into the artistic choices for this movie. So much so that for the first time on a Disney animated feature, one man, I'm probably going to mispronounce it, Ivan Earle, was in charge of the color, styling, background design, and the overall look of the film, even painting the great majority of the production backgrounds. His modernistic approach to design and painting resulted in giving the film a bold, unique art style. Even though his colleagues did not care for his production methods and his art style while the film was in production. The elaborate background paintings usually took 7 to 10 days to paint. By contrast, a typical animation background took 1 workday to complete.
Wow.
Yeah. And if you look at that movie, it looks like they're paintings.
Yeah, they do.
Like, they're that's so intricate about the art. There's just so much. Like I said, it's a design-driven film, and the film does not play down to children.
Mm-hmm.
It has comedic relief moments, but they're not dumb.
No, no.
Like, I think the dumbest part is the fact that, like, the mandolin player is getting drunk under the table, but...
But even then, that's kind of a... It's not something you would normally find in a kid's movie to begin with.
No.
Yeah.
No. Whereas, if you look at, like, Snow White and Cinderella,
mm-hmm.
it had a lot of, like, random subplots with, like, the animals or the dwarves
yeah.
and stuff. And you could have removed them and the movie would have been the same.
Mm-hmm.
But the comedic moments in this movie couldn't really be removed and keep the story intact.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they emphasize the story and the plot for for Sleeping Beauty.
Okay.
Yeah. One of the biggest comedic moments is the whole, like, cleaning of the house
mm-hmm.
When they were in the cottage and, like, trying to make the dress and bake the cake and stuff, right?
Yeah.
But it's funny, but it's all funny because of their characters.
Mm-hmm.
It's not funny just for being funny
mm-hmm.
or cute. Like, it pushes the plot because it's funny, but because of what they're doing, it causes the plot to move forward because they're now caught by the raven.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense?
Yeah.
So you can see how, like, a lot of attention went into that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They didn't outright say this, but essentially, Sleeping Beauty was almost like another attempt at high art. Just like Fantasia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And like we said, it focused on the battle between good and evil, and it emphasized goodness and love triumphing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a theme that was introduced in the ballet, like I said. And it combined elements from both the French and the German version of the story, and obviously some new stuff. Like Disney, it was definitely Disney that said, we need the prince and the princess to meet before she falls asleep.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that was where you get the idea of, like, them being betrothed and then, like, meeting each other as under, like, false pretenses. And,
yeah.
you know, this is fun. Although it's never stated in the film kind, you could make the argument,
mm-hmm.
and I've heard from some people, that the film has a Christian subtext.
Hmm.
And at the very least, it's the battle between good and evil.
Yeah.
But you can make the argument, and I think it's a little too on the nose for it not to be accurate,
mm-hmm.
that when he gets his sword and his shield, like, one, there is a cross on the shield.
Oh, yes.
Like, there didn't have to be a cross on the shield. Mm-hmm. You can make the argument it's the medieval period, they all had crosses, but
yeah.
they didn't have to put a cross on the shield. But two, she says, arm thyself with this enchanted shield of virtue and this mighty sword of truth,
mm-hmm.
for these weapons of righteousness will triumph over evil.
Mm-hmm.
And that is... Not anywhere a direct quote, but it is too similar to too many passages in the Bible, like not even just the armor of God.
Yeah,
but like some even like in the Old Testament, there's like scripture like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's just too on the nose for it not to have a subtext like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like,
well, I think it's plausible that you know, this was a different era in which morality and good and evil were looked at very differently. So I think that's a plausible one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I picked up on that. I did write.
But there's a lot of a lot of the old Walt Disney movies where there's like certain Christian subtext
mm-hmm.
to them. You can see like in how they change the stories and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think is a great thing. But
yeah,
So this is interesting. This is me here now. This is me. This isn't any research. It's just me.
Okay.
Despite modern criticism over a quick falling in love by the prince and the princess, which I've already kind of discussed is, like, we can get over that because it's already much better than the originals. Their plot about mistaken identity and the fact that they're betrothed, but they don't realize that the people they're in love with are those that they're betrothed to, that whole bit, if you think about it, is a very old trope. And it's very Shakespeare. You thought about that?
I haven't read enough Shakespeare to know.
Sure, it's fine.
Yeah.
But it's definitely like a very old, like, literature and play trope, where this idea of I'm betrothed to this person, but I don't really love that person. I'm in love with this person, but oh my gosh, this person was that person all along. Like, that's a very old trope.
Yeah.
And I think you can make the argument that, like, that's it's dumb that they use that, but I think it was used very well.
Yeah.
And I think it's got roots in a lot of, like, good literature and stuff that I think it's funny. I had this conversation with my friend Richard. I was saying a lot of people have issues with this, like, idea of, like, love at first sight and stuff. But I have a problem with love at first sight in a movie that's supposed to be based in reality. A movie that is clearly a fairy tale and is fictional.
Yeah.
I have no problem with love at first sight because it's already, like, romanticized.
Yeah.
If you don't have a problem with the fact there's a dragon in a movie, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I don't get it. Like, it's clearly not real. But that's me. I come from theater too, so what do you think?
No, I agree. I think, and this has kind of played out in some of our past podcasts, but where when I go see, and I've told you this before, when I go see a movie, I put my thinking cap aside for the most part. And I'm there to be entertained, not to be faced with reality. So when I'm watching a Disney cartoon, and this is why I have a hard time with this whole argument about Disney-fied fairy tales or whatnot, it's they're products of our society. You know, and I think oftentimes, even today, people take something and too deeply look into it and try to tear it apart. Because while you're discussing all this, the one that keeps coming to mind is the Disney did the kind of revised the story, the Sleeping Beauty story.
Disney already made these stories much less problematic.
No, that's not what I'm referring though.
Oh,
I'm
referring to, what are you talking about?
I'm referring to the contemporary versions.
Okay.
The Maleficent movies.
Oh, I didn't like those.
Yeah, but what is it? What are they basically trying to do? Humanize the villain?
Yeah, I don't like that.
I know, and I don't either. And so,
well, they humanize the villain, and then they demonize the good people.
Yes,
that's what I don't like.
It's the reason why I don't like the story, the musical Wicked. That, and I think the music's actually boring. Oh, but
I like Wicked. I get it, though. I get it. Yeah,
it's the contemporary idea of wanting to take a villain and minimize the good versus evil. You see this, it's one of my biggest complaints with comic books today. It's the idea of there's no real good guys. Everyone's flawed. And I get it, but going back to what you said before, when I'm watching something fictional, I could say the same thing about Love at First Sight. Us in reality know that there's a lot of problems with that can come with it because we are flawed in reality. But if I'm watching something fantastic, I'm cool with fantastic aspects of it.
And oddly enough, I think Disney in a weird way kind of covers their bases in that it is kind of a love at first sight, but in the end it's fine, it doesn't matter because they were going to be married anyways.
Yeah.
And because it was going to unify the two kingdoms. And so it kind of works out really well.
It does, because now they actually have, it's the best of both worlds.
Yeah, they have a relationship. They have a connection. It's not just a marriage because it's political reasons. And
yes. Which in real life we know most likely would have been the case. But hey, give us a story where everyone's happy.
Yeah. I mean, there's always times in these stories where people were in love, but more often than not, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you know this was the first Disney animated film where the prince actually takes an active role in defeating the main villain?
No, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So in Snow White, the evil queen fell off of a cliff
because
the seven dwarves were chasing her, and lightning struck it, which is, again, very different from the original story. And in Cinderella, Lady Tremaine was left with her daughters, after she went and married the prince.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she wasn't technically defeated so much as she just didn't win.
Yeah.
And Cinderella didn't have a prince save her in that one. Like, mm-hmm. like, she saw her chance to escape and she took it, you know?
That's true. That's, actually, I didn't even think about any of that.
Yeah. So anytime you hear people saying things like, "You needed, they needed princes to save them and stuff," I'm like, well, which movie are you talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny because, like, even when you think about, like, Enchanted, the Disney mm-hmm. movie, which is a great movie. I like Enchanted. All the movies that they're kind of making fun of mm-hmm. are basically just Snow White.
Yeah.
If you think about it.
Mm-hmm. Who defeats Ursula in Little Mermaid?
Technically, it is Prince Eric, but, mm-hmm. like, it's kind of a combo because Ariel does, like, stand up and, like, go after her to, like, stop the wedding. And then she's taken by Ursula because she ran out of time. But then Prince Eric... The thing in that one, I don't want to go off too much off track here.
Yeah.
The one thing that I stand by for that one is because she saved Prince Eric earlier in the film,
mm-hmm.
but because he had been looking for the voice, quote-unquote, the whole yeah. time and didn't know it was her,
mm-hmm.
the fact that he goes and saves her and defeats Ursula in the end, it's like an equilibrium
mm.
in that he... proves to her and he proves to King Triton that humans are good and that he does love her.
That's so putting that one aside, I mean, Maul aside, so I'm gonna have to pay more attention to that because now I'm realizing, like, a lot of times, a lot of the protest against Disney's past is really more caricatures that may not even exist.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I never even thought about that.
Mm-hmm. I know a lot of times Disney gets flack from certain people, like in certain people, like actors or actresses or mm-hmm. whoever who they, I don't even think they know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
It's like, have yeah. you seen the movie? And if you have, were you actually paying attention?
Yeah.
But I think it's like that with a lot of things in life. We have an idea of what we think something is. Mm-hmm. And then when you actually take a look at it and understand it, you're like, oh, I might not have understood this.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's our sidetrack. Other than that, I have some differences, and then I think I can start wrapping it up.
Cool.
So, the three good fairies, like we said, become the protagonists. They move the plot with their choices and their mistakes, more importantly.
Mm-hmm.
The three good fairies, they sacrifice and they take responsibility for Aurora. They remove her from her parents in order to protect her. Again, we said that's a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, it introduced a major climactic battle, which was not in... any other version
mm-hmm.
at all.
Yeah.
And part of that does go in line with the battle between good and evil. Because if you think about it from the point of view of, like I said, that now the fairies are the protagonists.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a battle between good and evil and they're the protagonists, like, it makes perfect sense because mm-hmm. it's them versus Maleficent, essentially.
Yeah.
And like everybody else is like, they're like a part of that story.
Mm-hmm.
But it's now the fairy story.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So I already said it's the first time the prince and the princess met and started some sort of relationship before she fell asleep. And this one eliminated the 100-year sleep. And it, like I said, introduced more tension with the ticking clock with the sun setting, but then also the kidnapping of the prince mm-hmm. added a lot of tension. The evil fairy takes on a much more active role with the fact that she hypnotizes Aurora and the fact that she's been trying to find Aurora this whole time. And the kidnapping the prince and then obviously stopping him from saving Aurora, like, she's much more active.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, again, the dragon.
Yeah.
Much the biggest change, probably. But, random note, I thought this was interesting. They designed the dragon snapping at Prince Philip based off of, I think it said a rattlesnake, like, preparing to snap.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then they said, this one's more fun.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever the dragon would spit out fire, they actually got that sound, which is a very specific sound,
mm-hmm.
from a recording of a flamethrower.
Wow.
Which makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
That interesting?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Do you have any other changes I didn't think about? Any differences?
No, I think you covered the most.
Yeah. I mean, it does stay very faithful.
It does. Like, it does. Yeah.
Like, if you think about in terms of, like, more modern adaptations, mm-hmm. like Tangled. Or Frozen.
Mm-hmm.
Those are so different.
Yes.
Like, they're just their own story. Yeah. Like, they're really just their own story with, like, the bare minimum the same,
mm-hmm.
which is fine. I have no problem with that. Mm-hmm. Like, I've always told people, if you want to change the story that much, just make your own story.
Yeah.
And change the names, mm-hmm. and they kind of do, but they don't.
Yeah.
But, you know, Disney is actually pretty faithful for the most part, you mm-hmm. know, and I like the changes, obviously, that they made.
Yeah. No, I did too.
Yeah.
After seeing it again for the first time in years, decades.
It's so gorgeous.
It was. I was very impressed with the animation. I guess as a kid or a teenager, I'm pretty sure I was a teenager the last time I saw it. I don't remember. I remember being bored by it. Mm. But
I mean, that makes sense, because if you think about it, somebody said that, this is funny, I once heard somebody say that Disney didn't really create Sleeping Beauty for children.
Mm-hmm.
Like, children can enjoy it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't necessarily, they weren't necessarily the target audience,
mm.
which may or may not be true.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that in the research that I did, and I knew some of this ahead of time a little bit, that because I have a Blu-ray copy and it has some of the behind-the-scenes stuff. Originally, when they were creating Sleeping Beauty,
mm-hmm.
they actually were going to have a lot of the music be similar to the music you find in Snow White and in Cinderella.
Mm.
Or in other Disney movies at the time, where it was mm-hmm. kind of like, upbeat, kind of giddy, and mm-hmm. like kind of silly, and
yeah,
and so they had a song called like Riddle Diddle and stuff like that, you know, like mm-hmm. it sounds like a cliche Disney song,
yeah,
but they purposely chose not to do that,
mm-hmm.
like they kind of scrapped a bunch of the songs and said, no, we're not doing that,
yeah, no, which, I could see the artisticness in it,
yeah, and I think that was a good choice.
Mm-hmm.
We did start to talk about how they use Tchaikovsky's music,
mm-hmm.
and I would say 80% of the composition is like directly lifted from Tchaikovsky.
Okay.
They got George Brun to do the music.
Mm-hmm.
What I thought of today that I thought was very interesting. So we talked about variations in dance.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what a variation is in music?
I'm assuming it's just where they change it so it goes along with a scene.
It's when they like play on a tune.
Okay.
And so it's the same tune, but they're messing with it.
Mm. Okay.
And so, like, Mozart famously did it with, it wasn't called this back in the day, but the tune of Twinkle Twinkle Little Star.
Yes.
Right? Mozart's has a very famous variations on that theme. Mm.
Okay.
Where he messes with it, and it's, like, at least, like, 12 different versions.
Oh, I know what you're talking about now. Yeah. Yes. Because I've actually
it's listened to variations. It's fun because some of them are pretty jazzy, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And for the 1700s, you know?
Yeah. I remember hearing the different variations.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. so I kind of realized in some way George Brun kind of made variations mm-hmm. of Tchaikovsky's score.
Okay.
Because it was like he took the music from the mm-hmm. score, but he didn't just copy the music.
Yeah.
Like, he expanded on it. He mm-hmm. and he rearranged it. Like, the music that was meant for specific scenes in the ballet, like, they changed it and they focused more on the emotion and the tone.
Okay.
And how it fit with the story.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, a lot of work went into that.
Yeah.
But I did tell someone the other day, I realized this, for all intents and purposes,
mm-hmm.
Sleeping Beauty is not a musical.
No, it's not.
Yeah. Compared to like everything else that they've done,
the one song, and that's pretty much it.
Right, in the very beginning, they have the song that everybody's singing when they're going to like celebrate the fact that the baby was born.
Oh yeah, that right? too.
There's that, but it's not like a traditional musical number.
Yeah, and then they have the Skumps.
Yeah, they have Skumps, but that even that one's kind of like a drinking song, like mm-hmm. they're toasting, right?
Yeah.
And other than that, there's one other number except for a reprise for Once Upon a Dream at the end. There's only one other number, and it's the number that's called Sleeping Beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And it's when everyone's going to being like put to sleep, essentially.
Yeah.
Even then, like, that's more of just like a tonal song.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to Cinderella and Pinocchio and Snow White and all the other ones, like, this was not a musical.
Mm-hmm.
It had some songs in it, but it was not a musical.
Yeah. No, I agree.
Yeah. So that was interesting. I didn't notice that until this last time. So you liked it?
I did. I did, even though I haven't seen it again after at a different age.
Yeah, I always say this is my favorite like classic Disney movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think now it's moved up a little higher than that because I have some Disney movies that are much more modern that I usually like to say I prefer, but this last viewing actually raised it, especially since I did the research, because I feel like I really appreciate it more. Yeah.
Yeah, we usually do. People tend to when you do more, look into things more.
Right. Mm-hmm. Just like how you like ballet more once you hear about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, so arbitrary score out of 10. One being, I wish I didn't watch this. 10 being, I wish I could watch this every day.
Probably a 7.
Really?
Yeah. Because even though...
That's less than the ballet.
It is, but I think in the ballet, maybe because it's a simplistic story and the art was cool, I think I would probably watch something... I'd be more inclined to watch more making of videos than to watch the story again anytime soon.
That makes sense, I guess.
Yeah. And it's like, I think if I do sit down and watch it, it will be only a while. But whereas the ballet, because it's so brand new and there's a lot of things I missed,
yeah,
I'm more likely to watch that.
That makes sense, I guess. I really want to give this a 10. But just like any good work of art, like, I think you can only watch so much of it because it's so good. Like, I think I will always watch this movie, but I don't think I watch it like all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I really want to give it a 10, but I think we'll give it a 9.
Okay.
Yeah. It's so good, though.
Mm-hmm. It was.
There's really nothing wrong with it. Mm-hmm. Like, you could say it has some slow moments, and there could be something that you just personally don't like about it for whatever reason, but it's a very well-made movie.
Yeah. You're actually making me rethink my score. I might move it up to an 8.
I'll take it.
Yeah.
That's balanced.
I think I would move up to an 8 because the more you were saying right now, I probably would be more inclined to watch this than even, say, Frozen.
Frozen's a good movie. It's just not worth the hype.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. So we'll move on to the final thing, which is what kind of adaptation is this? And again, for anybody who has not listened to our podcast before, this is the time of the show where we discuss the types of adaptations that I've come up with. If you have not listened to our episodes, please go back and listen to the trailer because that's when we actually go more in depth about what each of these adaptations are. To be real quick, there is true to source material, there is expanded, there's artistic, and then there is message driven. So, Rami, what type of adaptation is this?
Slightly expanded.
Okay.
I mean, because it's not true to source. I mean, it is, but it's not.
It is, but it isn't.
Yeah, because it's like there.
It hits all the beats.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not true.
Would it be considered artistic? Because it's a different medium?
It's very design-driven, but artistic, I think we were saying it usually like involves like visual metaphors and
this
things
one doesn't
like
have that.
And it's not necessarily that. I want to say it's artistic just because it's so design-driven. Like, it fits.
I find this one is hard to fit into a category.
It is. I think I might have to go with message-driven because they really emphasize the fact that it's the battle between good and evil, and then because they change the focus to the fairies.
Oh, the POV is different in a way.
So I feel like I might have to stick with message-driven because of that.
Whereas, well, okay, I mean, if we would have known what the morals were in the original ones, just by trying to spell them out, they don't make sense to us contemporary readers, at least you and I, maybe other people see it. But yeah, I agree with you. I think this one is more message-driven because the message is actually something that us in our time can get.
Mm-hmm. It's an artistically message-driven.
Yeah, there you go. Artistically message-driven. Great. I agree.
I really liked this one. This was a fun one.
It was. Yeah. Yeah.
I hope I didn't like just get people to listen to me and go, "Well, that was super nerdy."
No, I kind of wanted to do some more. This time around with the Disney one, my goal was to look at some videos and do some deep dive, but I just didn't have the time.
I'll send you some stuff.
Okay.
Yeah. This was fun.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I didn't do as much research on this one.
We have some other Disney movies eventually we'll talk about for sure. Maybe not right off the bat again, but yeah. Again, we like to have a bit of a range here. Other than that, anything else you want to add to this before we take off?
No. Just if any of our listeners happen to be experts in fairy tales, we'd love to hear from you.
Sure.
Anything we missed or you disagreed with,
Let us know. Send us an email.
Definitely.
Yeah.
We're always ready to learn more, to look at things from different perspectives.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So yep. I enjoyed it. Like you said, I enjoyed it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Looking forward to another deep dive into something else.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was really hoping to get my brother to like be here to like mm-hmm. add to the ballet section. But it just didn't work out. But maybe later on, if we do Swan Lake or Nutcracker or definitely. Something, he can help. But yep. Thank you, Romy.
All right.
I hope you all have a good... I'm going to start that over. Hope you all take care of yourselves out there.
Yes. I know for us, it may be night, but it might be daytime for you. So sure. Have a good day, and we hope you can enjoy this episode and look forward to having you for the next one.
Great.
All right.
All right, bye.
Bye.
All right, stop it.
Thank you for listening to our podcast, Willing to Adapt.
Please like and subscribe. Maybe leave a review or just share us with friends and family.
We would also love if you would follow us on social media.
If you have ideas for future episodes for us, please email us at ericandromy@willingtoadapt.com.
That's Romy with an I.
And remember, when the only thing constant in life is change, be willing to adapt.